Interview with Gordon Lish. This was recorded June 29th, 1983 at WCBS. Lish, an editor at Knopf, is the author of Dear Mr. Capote. You live here in Manhattan?
You bet, yeah.
Whereabouts?
Up on 96 and 5th.
We're across the park from you. We live at 97 Park West Village, which is a large apartment complex at 97th Street in Central Park West.
Uh-huh. That Roy Blunt just moved up there, I think.
Roy Blunt did?
Yeah, you know who Roy Blunt is?
Yeah, I know. I didn't know he lived. He was living in Massachusetts.
He just moved down to New York.
I think he did.
He had a long apartment down here.
Mm-hmm. Incredible.
He's a funny man.
As a matter of fact, I just had
him. I believe so.
A couple of months ago.
Is that a fact?
Yeah.
He's a funny man, isn't he?
Oh, he's hilarious. We talked about his book,
Soup.
One Fell on the
Soup.
Highway of Life.
What's that? Oh yeah, that's
a bug.
That's a poem he wrote. He may have converted that into a book.
It was the title of a book of poetry.
Yeah.
And various essays. And
published a book of his called Crackers.
Yes.
Which I insist is his funniest ever.
I saw. Matter of fact, I knew he was coming in. I didn't know it at the time I saw the book, but I saw a copy of Crackers in a. Mm-hmm. Garage sale for 50 cents.
Is that a fair?
And the next week I realized he was coming in. Mm-hmm. And so I went back. This was actually like a thrift shop at 106th Street in Broadway. So I went back.
He used to have an apartment up there, though, maybe.
I didn't even know he lived in New York for some reason.
Kept an apartment on 106th Street, yeah.
So I think we'll just talk. I have a few questions I'd like to ask you about yourself and about editing, but mostly about the book, which I have to say on the outset, I admired very, very much.
Oh, thank you.
But I have some questions about it.
You bet.
And I'm glad you're here because there are some things I did not understand. Some things that I was confused about a little bit, and probably because of my own ignorance. I was not sure. One, he had me going. The narrator had me going because I think I assumed that perhaps he had been in radio at one point back in those early days of soaps. And then I began to realize that, indeed, he couldn't have been, and he didn't have the depth or the intelligence, or the education, apparently the vocal range, and, indeed, at one point, one of the other characters describes his job as that of a messenger.
Yeah.
With that in mind, I began to wonder if, indeed, he did commit all of the, I think, 23 murders, and I was not sure at the end whether he did. And was this something in my lack of perception, or what? Or was this meant to be somewhat up in the air?
So far as I can see, every reader's had it a different way. It is intended that one sees that he, in fact, has not killed anyone at all, that he's incapable of killing, that he would like to be able to do so, that certainly his ambition to kill enough people in order to generate an exciting enough story to provide for bestseller in order to secure the future of his son is indeed a notion of his, but never really achieves any kind of reality. So no, he's not killing anyone. In fact, the clues to suggest as much are subtilized in the extreme. I think you mainly get it in a scene near the back end of the book when his wife is heard speaking, and she says in that peculiar voice, that voice is peculiar to her, "No, you couldn't off anybody." There's a couple of blankety blank words back there. I can't give you the exact line, but I think that the indication is rather oblique, but there, that he's not in fact killing anybody. And now, how much of what he is telling you can be relied on as fact and cannot is difficult to determine. I would say certainly all the radio experience is false. He was a child who lived inside the radio. The program that he's most obsessed with, Young Dr. Malone, that was, he reports, his mother's favorite radio program. His connection with the radio as a, in any kind of work sense was, as you reported, as a messenger, which job he gets through a man named Bill Leto, who is a staff announcer at Mutual. A long-winded answer to it.
That's all right. The reference to, is it Brian? No. Buddy Brown.
Buddy Brown, yeah.
The reference to Buddy Brown. Buddy Brown never appears in the book. And I get the impression that he was the boy next door that the character's mother admired.
Yes.
The photograph.
Yes,
was there.
Yes.
And,
yes. The boy who was somewhat more beautiful than the narrator, yeah. Yeah.
I didn't quite understand this. Was this character, this Buddy Brown, part of the reason for the, I hate to keep using the term character, but I don't believe he has a name, does he?
Yes, well, Davy, I mean, he talks about his brother Davy, but I think it's probably fair to say that the narrator's name is Davy. There is no brother named Davy. He is Davy.
Oh, boy.
That's so that all right. Every reviewer has had a different apprehension of that, but he does say at one point, or it's clear in one conversation with his mother on the telephone that he's Davy, that he has no brother drowned, as he reports to us. The boy next door, Buddy Brown, who apparently was a very fetching child and sought the eye of Davy's mother, and who sort of replaces him in her esteem, is in fact killed in an accident, which is probably not so much an accident as intention. There were children up on a top floor or the attic of an unfinished house playing Simon Says. Our narrator, Davy, is sort of the leader of the game, and through some contrivance in the game gets Buddy Brown to step forward into a shaft wherein a chimney was going to be laid in, and the boy falls down to the basement. So it's a kind of murder then, in fact. That's the one killing he has done.
T.C. confused me, because obviously Truman Capote, T.C., and then I began to realize he wasn't talking about Truman Capote, and it became apparent I had to go back, because I tend to read in paragraphs, and you have the kind of book that is not easily read in paragraphs.
No, sir.
And so you can miss clues very easily. And so I missed that when I had to go back and find out that T.C. was actually his wife.
His wife, Tamara Criss, whom he calls T.C., from Salem, Oregon, right, and whose initials are the same as Truman Capote's.
This obviously was deliberate. Why did you do this?
No, it really wasn't deliberate. It is the kind of thing that fascinates the narrator in his madness, as would any sort of coincidence. In my judgment, one of the things that characterizes insanity is the wish to see parallels and systems, to make systems out of things which are really unrelated and disparate. And so that Davy spends an awful lot of time in the course of the letter he's writing to Capote finding connections between things which really have no connection at all. It is simply happenstantial that his wife's initials are the same as the man he's writing to. But he makes much of this, as he makes much of the fact that he has been writing also to Norman Mailer, and that in both the name Norman and in the name Truman, one can devise the word M-A-N. I mean, this also seems very significant to him. Everything seems significant to him, and it's been my observation that one of the things peculiar to psychosis is the imposing of middle terms on all sorts of absolutely unrelated elements. You see this often manifest itself in paranoid systems that would have it that the world is in the domination of a small group of conspiring persons, or that this event happening over here is somehow tied to that event happening over there, is tied to that event happening over there, and the whole thing makes perfect sense. In fact, in my judgment, doesn't make perfect sense. Things just don't have those causal relationships, and the fact that you can find in the names of two prominent American writers the word M-A-N is scarcely of any consequence at all. But it has enormous importance for our narrator, for Davy. He seems to see that as immensely implicit of some kind of meaning.
Davy has a lust, obviously, or at least an obsession with Janet Rose. I have the name right, Janet Rose?
Yes, that's it. Janet Rose, Janet R.
And yet, very little is mentioned except in the most oblique way of his wife. Did I miss this?
Well, he
did
talks
he ever
about...
Have a direct, was it ever established where he had met his wife? In your
no, in one version of the book, I had laid in an episode where this improbable matrimony came to pass. I subsequently took it out, thinking it was simply a diversion. That had not greatly to do with what the book is about. The narrator's, Davy's remarks about his wife have chiefly to do with the sexual relations between them and, with her failure, additionally, to, relate to their son in a way that suits Davy, that she is, that TC is insufficiently attentive to his education, to his training, that she's not, adequately observing of the family rule of safety first, that she thinks that he is absurd in his cautionary and his cautions to his son. As you may recall, the boy carries a walkie-talkie that the father has the mate of and with him, and the father keeps tabs on his son in the course of the day. And the mother, TC, the father tells us, thinks this is ridiculous behavior, and of course it is ridiculous behavior. But what I was saying is that TC is only important insofar as she represents a kind of antagonism for the peculiar madness of the narrator. And although TC represents a commonsensical point of view, I think one of the curious things about the book is that you tend to side with the narrator, who's quite mad, obviously, and whose point of view is truly absurd, and yet somehow it seems appealing, seems to make sense to be as cautionary as he is and as paranoid as he is, particularly in the frame of New York City.
That's true. You feel a certain fondness for the narrator, because I think we meet so many people like that all around us.
Well, I think one of the
in every facet of our lives.
One of the things that's been remarked about this book, and it pleases me that it's being remarked, is that because I did set out to contrive this effect, and that is that such a repugnant human being, if we take him at his word. Is in the, over the course of the letter he's writing to Capote, made sympathetic. I think that that does happen in most readings, and it's a remarkable thing to behold, because everything about this man is really repugnant. There's nothing about him that's appealing. He is, at his own word, an entirely ridiculous character, obsessed with silly things, petty. Small-minded, bigoted, in any number of ways, insufficiently human and humane, and yet, in the course of the book, would seem from most of the reviews that have thus far been entered, the reader finds himself persuaded of the appeal of poor Davy.
Well, I believe that is the case, because all of us have these same prejudicial feelings, and I think all of us have small bouts of madness as we go about our lives, and all of us do things that may not be dissimilar to the character.
No, I would like to think so, and in fact, I must admit that in the course of creating this fellow's voice, I put in his mouth any number of observations that I would be happy to make myself.
I noticed, I came to the chapter in which his mother speaks, and I was, I don't know that I was surprised, but his mother spoke in an identical way as the narrator.
Well, he's surrounded by cliché. Davy is, and I don't think this is really unlike the shaping of any of us. He's the result of the language that he's heard, and particularly the idiomatic expressions that fascinate any child. I was thinking on my way over here this morning of a remark my mother used to make again and again when I was a child, a place for everything and everything in its place. It just suddenly came to me that my mother used to say that all the time, and that it had a special kind of almost magical incantatory effect on me. I liked that. I liked hearing it. The content of it meant nothing to me at all, although I understood it when I was a child to be a kind of scolding, that she was admonishing me to put something away. The repetition of the language and the neatness, the rightness of the language had a kind of very calming, satisfying effect on me. Just as, to now return to Dear Mr. Capote, Ben Burney's sign-off has for Davy when he's a child. He hears this peculiar way of a real band leader, used to end his program back in the 40s, and it has a soothing effect on him, as does all these idioms and these cliches that are peculiar to his mother and peculiar to other people. So that what Davy is, what he is as an adult, a man 47 years old, is the sum of all these idioms, the sum of all these cliches. He can speak in nothing but cliches. And we eventually discover when we hear the mother speaking that many of these cliches derive from her. In fact, some derive from other persons in the book as well. And I think the bulk of us are the net result of the cliché we've been surrounded by. And I don't think that's necessarily an awful thing. I think obviously the point is made extreme in this book, but I think on careful examination, we find that the bulk of our ideas, the bulk of our impressions, the bulk of our ways of being in the world and ways of saying things back to the world arrive out of what's been programmed into us from our earliest perceptions. And most of these things are, in fact, clichés. In fact, the cliché is generally, in my judgment, not only a more readily adapted input, but also in a kind of way a more desirable input, in that it has, as I was suggesting earlier, a kind of shamanistic, ritualistic effect for us. It is calming, it is a social mechanism, it works. It's always worked, and we know it'll work for us, and it sort of places us in the world and protects us from the world. It's that ceremony of language that makes all sorts of human exchanges possible.
I was going to say, it's also a form of shorthand.
Sure, sure.
We have what we call institutional cliches that are used in broadcasting. Posh hotel, mm-hmm. shark-infested mm-hmm. water. Mm-hmm. These things make it easier for us to tell a story without thinking.
You bet. And Davy is just an extreme example of this. He can speak in nothing but clichés. But I think most of us speak in at least moderated clichés, most of the time, if not all the time.
Well, I have to say that this, Gordon Lish, you certainly put me behind in my work. Because my broadcast is every day. And as I started reading, I found that I could not hurry because you had a language all of your own in the book that required concentration and understanding. It was nothing that you could breeze through, and it required looking at almost every word and every line to better comprehend the character.
I wanted a voice that sounded like nothing else you'd ever heard before and yet sounded awfully familiar in a kind of way. I wanted a book that was as erotic as I could make it. I wanted a book that was as shocking as I could make it. I wanted to do a lot of things toward that effort of taking the reader by the neck, seizing his attention, and forcing his face down onto the page. So I'm pleased with it. I think some of that effect has been achieved.
You have been an editor for quite a number of years. Did you find that you as an editor also needed an editor?
I certainly did, and I had the great good luck of having a first-rate one whose name is Billy Abrams. One of the things that astonished me in the course of the development of the book is that, contrary to my expectations, I was just as blind to the failures of the book, the excesses in the book, the insufficiencies in the book, as I have observed any writer that's come to me has been about his own book. I don't think an editor can edit himself, just as we are told no doctor should properly try to treat himself. I certainly was proved absolutely incompetent to see my book in the kind of light that I would see the work of someone else as an editor.
How did you set out to write Dear Mr. Capote? Did the character develop as you began to write, or did you have a fairly good idea of where you wanted to go as you started?
No, I didn't, Don. I had a kind of voice in my head. I knew roughly how I wanted this fellow to sound, but how you then translate that to the page is another problem. And I tried again and again and again to get it onto the page so it would look like what it sounded like in my head. And that took many, many, many tries. I must have made at least 100 runs at this book, getting into it anywhere from 20 to 100 pages, before I finally got the voice the way I wanted it. Where the idea came from was simple enough. I saw an ad for a book called Son of Sam, which was, in fact, the authorized biography of this fellow who's a mass murderer here in New York. It suddenly occurred to me, the advertisement expressed pride in the presentation of this book, that here was an event to behold, that money would be made from this, and that the persons involved with the enterprise were pleased with what was to be presented to the public for sale, as of course they should be. Here's a product. And that's, I think, where the idea came to me of a fellow who would get it into his head that one way to, in a very excellent way, without much training in life and without much skill and without much prospect, to make a bundle is to start killing a lot of people and sell your story. And it occurred to me that that notion may have occurred to a lot of people. Might right now be occurring to a lot of people. And here we have a fellow to whom it's occurred because he has heard some government broadcast or some government report saying that the generation that his son belongs to is going to have it worse than the generation that he belonged to, and there's just no possible prospect for this boy to live any better than the dad lived, and the dad lived pretty awful. So he sets out because he is so devoted to this child to kill a lot of people and sell his story to Truman Capote or to Norman Mailer. Of course, as I said at the opening of our discussions, he is not really killing anybody. It's something he would like to do. He talks about doing it, thinks about doing it. I think most psychotics practice their psychosis in the abstract. They don't really get out and act out all that much. They don't get out and kill people or do funny things in public. Probably the bulk of their madness takes place inside their skulls. But anyhow, that's how the idea came to me. And the problem I set for myself was to take a fellow like this, whom I thought was an ordinary enough fellow, and sort of decorate him out with a rather considerable array of disgusting mannerisms, and yet make him, in the end, a desirable, pathetic, sympathetic person, as a victim as much as a victimizer.
Gordon Lish, as you wrote Dear Mr. Capote, did you have any self... The book has been received critically. But did you have any self-doubts about it, that who would want to read it? Why would somebody want to read about this corrupt person?
Enormously. I tell you precisely how I felt at the completion of the thing. I knew that that what I'd done was what I'd wanted to do, that the book was intricate in a way that I wanted to be, and it was sort of shocking in a way that I wanted to be, that it accomplished those things. But I worried about the total effect. I thought it might look foolish, that I might look foolish. And I can recall passing the book on to an editor pal of mine prior to showing it to the fellow who subsequently published the book, Billy Abrams, at Holt, and asking my friend to read this thing and tell me honestly if he thought I was being silly. That was the one question I think I wanted answered. I was nagged by the suspicion that I was making a fool of myself. I've written a number of short stories, written many novels under other names. This was the first thing to come from my hand where I felt I may have gone so far as to be holding myself up to terrible ridicule. And I now think that probably that concern was a very healthy one, and in a way sort of was an index to the extent to which I had achieved what I've often argued as the most important principle in doing art, and that is to take every risk that you can at that time. I mean, I suppose I went about as far as I could go at the time I wrote that book, and that's why I was concerned that I'd gone too far. I don't think you ever can go too far. I'm writing a novel now that I've been at for about 3 years, called a book called Dilation, and I'm finding that however greatly one wants to be reckless, there are certain very considerable limitations on one's abilities. You just can't be reckless enough, and I think it's important to be reckless if one wants to do art. If one wants to be serviceable, there's just too much clutter in the world, in my judgment, in relation to what's done as art. And I think if you want to do something, if you're determined to do something that is exceptional, and or that is at least unique, you have to go just about as far as you can go. And the great sadness is not that we are insufficient in our will to do this, but rather that we simply don't have the goods to go far enough.
Aren't you afraid what your mother is going to say?
hugely, hugely. My mother is a woman virtually in her 90s, and she's not much of a reader anymore. My dad is a couple of years younger, and he's not much of a reader either. Both of these persons have the book in their possession. I hope that neither one has opened it up to have a look at it. I think their pleasure is simply seeing their son's name on the cover.
What about you have four children? What about them? Do you keep the book away? Are you old enough to understand the erotic areas in the book?
I've kept it away from my 11-year-old. I have a 26-year-old, a 24-year-old, and a 21-year-old. They've all read it, and they all think Daddy's just a heck of a guy.
I go along with that. One other question. I could ask you questions for the next 2 hours, but unfortunately the time is about over for us. But you obviously are now a very successful writer with a critically acclaimed novel, but you are also an important editor. And have you found that being an editor in any way makes it more difficult for you to write?
It sure does. I am determined to say these things about those cases where editors write. I always took the position that it was a mistake for them to do this, that their own writers paid a price for it, that the writing they did paid a price for it, that it would be a good idea for anyone who wanted to be a writer, never to be an editor. And now I find myself in the position of having to try to justify doing the very thing that I've always decried as a bad practice, and a very common practice, too. As much as I would like to say that this new enthusiasm for writing has not interfered with my relation to my own writers, that's the case, I know in fact it's not. I know that a part of me is not available to them. I know that I read in a different kind of way now. I know that that my ego has gotten in the way of their ego. There's no way you can do this thing, that is to say, write, and not be in competition with other writers, with all other writers. And that's an untenable position for an editor to have. So it's not a good thing, and I don't know how to resolve it. I certainly cannot see myself ever not being an editor. It's what I've always wanted to be. It's what I do best. On the other hand, I have a great commitment to at least finishing the book I remarked earlier, Dilation. I'm determined to do that. I have a collection of stories coming out with Holt next year, next spring. I'm pleased about that, of course. I think after Dilation, I might have had my fill of this thing and see the wisdom of stopping it. I'm hoping to make that book everything that Dear Mr. Capote wasn't, so that I can have some sense of having said what I have to say and quitting it at that point. Because I would rather spend the last of my professional years as an editor, I think, than as a writer. Well, just to begin with, it's much more pleasant work. Writing is not fun. And I've always thought being an editor was great fun. In this respect, I will remark something that a piece of wisdom that once came out of Ken Kesey's mouth when he was talking about the his explanation for why One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was such a fine book, certainly a fine book in my judgment. He said, you know, it was fun to write. It was really fun to write. And I can't say I have fun writing, and I do have a lot of fun editing. I mean, and that's why I think I do it rather well.
Burton Lish, will you make one promise to me when Dilations comes out? Will you come back so we can talk about that?
You bet. Be tickled to.
Thank you.